This is episode number 51 with Will Klipkin, managing partner and co-founder at Cocoon Capital. Welcome to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. My name is Andrew Sendek, a former banker turned tech entrepreneur, and in each episode, I interview the movers and shakers of the venture capital and investment space in Southeast Asia, with the only goal to help you discover how to raise more capital, build better companies, and to give you a better understanding of the people behind the biggest funds in the region. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Now let's get started. All right, beautiful people, welcome to a new episode. If you've listened to the show many times, then you'll know that I love entrepreneurs turning investors. And today we have the honor and the privilege to be joined by Will Klipkin from Cocoon Capital. And if you just look at the track record, I just get excited about it. But a few highlights from Will. There's a lot of things I can actually say, but I just want to mention a few things. CTO, co-founder of Kelco, okay. CTO and founder of Zoomit.com, entrepreneur in residence with INSEAD, managing partner at Tigris Capital, and currently managing partner and co-founder of Cocoon Capital. What is Cocoon Capital? A Singapore-based early-stage venture firm investing in Southeast Asia's smartest B2B e-commerce, fintech, SaaS, and deep tech founders to move them quickly to Series A and beyond. Portfolio, amongst others, is a BuyMat, Foodraiser, JazzyPay, and many more. Will, welcome to the show. Happy to see you up in Norway in the mountains where it's cold, I reckon. Colder than here. But welcome, welcome.
Yeah, how's everything? Still cold. Still cold. Thank you so much. Hey.
Good to see you. Good to see you. How's life there? How's life in the mountains? Thanks.
Well, life is good. I mean, there's not as much snow as last year, but, you know, still cold. Global warming hasn't completely removed the snow yet. So, you know, still trying to ski a little bit, you know.
Yeah, is there some ski there?
While it's still possible. Oh, yeah. We can still go up on the mountain pass and then ski. Yeah, it's beautiful up there.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So you got some pretty good extremes, right? Mm-hmm. In a few weeks, you're going to go back to Singapore and it's going to be 30 degrees better, I would say.
No, it's good for health and good for the body to be, you know, it's like having a cold shower, right?
So. Exactly. Before we start, I think a big shout out to Michael Grijsils because he's the one that introduced us. So Michael, if you're listening, a big thank you to you. You know what? I was looking at the Cocoon Capital's website and I just read something which I think is a good segue to start with, where it says that Cocoon invests slowly to let us focus, right? Investing slowly to let us focus. And I think it's a good way to kind of like talk into, you know, what is slowly investing in an environment which is fast-paced, where unicorn companies can be reached within 2-3 years. $100 million fundraising is happening on a daily. How do you invest slowly? What does that mean to you, investing slowly?
Hey, that's a good question. I mean, sometimes I go on stage, I said this before, with people from 500 startups, and, you know, they've been really successful in many of their funds. And I usually say, if you're 500 startups, we are five startups, because we do five startups a year, and, you know, 500 probably do they do so many that they don't even remember all the startups they invest in. But, you know, it's a different kind of strategy. It's a different asset class. And if you go for the kind of spray and pray, you go for the asset class of early stage investing, which is with certain targets, it could be quite exciting because you catch the unicorns. They have also kind of gone into a strategy where they invest in everything in the market. We went in 2016 and we said, you know, business to business companies, enterprise tech companies are super underinvested. That's number one. Number two, entrepreneurs need time and they also need, you know, assistance. And sometimes in many cases, we can assist entrepreneurs with everything that's non-core. Mm. And when I say that, there are two important things. First of all, you know, we don't know the right answer to anything. And if we knew that, we would probably do a unicorn ourselves. Obviously, we're not that smart. We're just investors or, you know, ex-entrepreneurs that used to be smart at some point. what we do is that we help entrepreneurs find ways to make decisions. So we try to find best practices on how to reach decisions, how to listen to the market, not only to yourself, right? how to experiment, small experiments, not huge experiments. And then we tend to help with the non-core stuff of running a company. That means all the boring stuff that entrepreneurs don't want to really know about, but they would at some point have to know about it, or they would hire other people that do the, for them, non-exciting stuff. Like I remember when I was an entrepreneur, I didn't understand and / hated everything that was non-tech in the company. So I felt sorry for people that didn't work in the tech department, because I thought they probably didn't, you know, manage to get into the right engineering schools, and instead they had to do marketing and finance and all the other things, and HR. And then, of course, later I realized that these are very important jobs as well. So I know exactly where a lot of entrepreneurs are coming from, but we can help them with all these kind of boring, non-core parts of the business, and kind of help them find the right people, think around the right strategies. And of course, a lot of what we do is also helping them with the next round of financing. And we basically said we cannot help more than 5-6 companies a year, because we're only 2 managing partners. We have a great team of people. So they're, of course, also part of this. But even with the great team of people in an early stage fund, we simply are as, you know, modest and humble that we really don't think we can help more than 5 to 6 companies here. And that means that my managing partner, business partner, and myself, we are on average 2 to 3 boards, new boards a year. And that's basically what we think is possible. And then we have a window, right? We help companies across a section of like 24 months. After 24 months, we kind of expect the companies to go on to a new investor. We have it as our main goal to raise an amazing Series A round for the seed companies we invest in. Again, we only invest at seed as the primary intro into a company. We might follow on in certain instances in later rounds to keep our maintain our ownership in the companies. But our main business is to go into the seed stage and then help them for 24 months and then kind of step down on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis.
That's a very, very clear timeline, right? And when you say like seed round, which, you know, I think even like 5-6 years ago, a seed round was like literally, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand, right? But now, yeah. now I see seed rounds, which are like a couple of million bucks, right? So what is the definition in Cocoon's dictionary?
Yeah, it's obviously changing as we speak. And there's inflation. There's a lot of investor interest into Southeast Asia, which is good news for everyone. But for us, a seed round is around up to $1 million US. Typically, that's where we feel we can kind of participate in the game. But of course, if you look at Silicon Valley, seed rounds can be 10 million US easily. We're not there.
Yeah, we're not there. But I do think that in Southeast Asia, we see some trends where these early stage companies, whether they call it pre-seed, pre-A, or mm-hmm. whatever they want to call it, mm-hmm. that these sure. rounds are kind of like inflating, right? Which brings me to an interesting topic, which I was just reading about this company, this US company, fast.com, where, you know, they raised over $100 million and they just closed shops, right? They just closed the doors because they were just burning money all the way. How do you look at those type of developments happening in the US versus now these big rounds happening in Southeast Asia? Is there some type of worry, especially coming from a quote unquote more conservative or more patient investor, you know, versus the pop, 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 we spray and pray type of investor? Is there some type of worry, quote unquote worry, if you look at the trends within the ecosystem?
Well, I don't worry so much about companies raising a lot of money. They won't be raising that from us, so it won't be my money. But I think it's great to have big rounds. I just think that there are always these micro bubbles, right? You have certain sectors. If you look at fintech in the last 24 months, where you've seen quite amazing valuations based on revenue. You have definitely the crypto space, where you see an inherent kind of acceleration of valuations. And of course, in built-in, less interest in dealing with traditional old dinosaur investors like venture capitalists, where I definitely see that there are micro bubbles that have to be adjusted at some point. But I think in general, it's great. You have to realize that Southeast Asia is an interesting place. you go to Bali or Singapore, where you have, you know, international entrepreneurs coming in and sometimes solving international problems. And they are mixed up with people coming from countries like Indonesia or Vietnam, right? Solving big problems in their own markets. These are very different businesses. And also, of course, we are more in the B2B space, enterprise space, where our premise is that you can build a global business that stands out from its competitors with an investment of less than 10 million.
Yeah.
Because you're not dealing with consumers. You're not dealing with irrational buyers. You're supposedly dealing with rational, you know, business buyers that if they see the right solution there, they will buy it if the price is right. So it's a complicated picture. We definitely see inflation coming in. there might be over investments. I haven't really seen any crazy rounds that I cannot explain, perhaps except for the crypto space where I've seen a few in Southeast Asia that I cannot explain, but the rest seems still to be pretty reasonable. I would say there's still room for increasing valuations in Southeast Asia to be more in line with or on par with the rest of the world.
Yeah, yeah. If we go back 2016, the beginnings of Cocoon, right? There's something that you shared with me in our initial call where you said like, okay, you know what? We didn't pay ourselves for, I don't know, was it a year or a couple of years, like the first.
We're still not getting paid.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So this is an interesting one, right? Because I think from the outside, you would say like, okay, you know what, having a fund, you see the headlines. And of course there's this assumption, right? The assumption where, you know, these VC investors could be kind of like these sharky investors and, you know, they're the ones that are running the ticket. They're the ones kind of like driving, like where, you know, what category is gonna happen, yes or no? What category is hot or not? Take us back a bit to the kind of like the beginnings of Cocoon. Like, what was it that triggered you to? I know you've been part, of course, of the venture space for a long time after you were an entrepreneur, right? But what's kind of like what has been the catalyst for Cocoon specifically, and then building the team from zero? Like, how was that?
Oh, okay. So there are multiple parts of this. I mean, I think in 2015, you know, the Singapore ecosystem started basically when I came to Singapore in 2004. At that time, there was basically no venture funds in Singapore, or very, very few. And they were basically government funded. And then what happened throughout 2004 to 2015, so in those 11 years, you basically built an ecosystem from scratch. Some serious money came online, and I had basically by then been a business angel. So I did around 2 investments per year. That wasn't a very intense job, I have to admit that. If you have to do 2 investments in 12 months, you know, you can sleep in the morning and you can go on long holidays. And then in 2015, we basically saw that to be able to kind of keep up with this, and also, of course, with the larger round being raised, and also realizing that, you know, a lot of the investments I took part in were syndications, right, with multiple investors coming in. It would be kind of much better to be able to take the full seed investment. And at that time, there were no real seed investors. There were a lot of people that wanted to be seed investors, but they actually really wanted to be Series A investors. They quickly moved from an initial small fund into raising a larger fund. And I don't want to speculate, but you know, a lot has to do with the kind of troublesome space you are in as a seed fund. And the trouble I'm referring to is that, I mean, it sounds, perhaps if you raise $30 million to most people, that's a lot of money. To me, it's a lot of money, you know, but VCs operate by charging a fee every year on the size of the fund, right? And if you charge, and typically you charge 1, sometimes 2, sometimes you convince your investors that you can charge 3%. And we didn't really want to play that game either. But the trouble is that as a small fund, you don't really have a lot of potential to raise or to basically get management fees. So a lot of VCs say, to be able to have a good staff here and to be able to pay ourselves our $300,000 a year salary, we need to raise a bigger fund. And therefore, seed doesn't make sense. We need to raise the $100 million Series A funds. And that's the target. So we basically said, you know what, Michael Blakey, my co-founder, a successful early stage investor from the UK, moved to Singapore in 2013. And me, we met up there and we kind of realized that we were probably the only 2 people that actually had made, across time, consistently good returns on just investing as business angels. and being a bit involved in the companies, but investing quite slowly. And we said, you know what? If we're ever going to do a fund, which we should do, this is the space we need to be in, because that's where we were successful. We don't really know how to run a good Series A fund or B fund or angel fund. We know how to basically run a seed fund. Mm. So we said, okay, let's raise somewhat of a good sized fund, but we can't raise too much because we can't deploy fast enough, right? And if you only do 5 companies a year, which we have done on average, and we only do $1 million in initial round and perhaps a little bit more as follow on, there's a limit on how much money we can spend.
Yeah.
So we have the opposite problem of entrepreneurs. They want to raise and get money. We have to deploy money, right?
Yeah.
And that's also difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we basically decided that let's raise a small fund. Also, let's try not to be the typical VC investor. Nothing wrong with VC managers having management fees and taking high salaries. But we basically said, let us try to be a different kind of VC fund that's kind of on the side of not only the entrepreneurs, but also on the side of the investors.
Mm.
So we said, first of all, we're going to spend a lot of time with the company. So being on the side of the entrepreneurs, but also we will not pay ourselves a salary. Mm. So we are on the side of the LPs and our investors. They don't get the salary either, right?
Yeah.
The only time we're going to get paid is when we make the entrepreneurs rich and we return a lot of money to the LPs.
Yeah.
So we try to align ourselves with our 2 stakeholders.
That's beautiful.
If that was a wise decision, I don't know. If that gives me a lot of free cash for running Cocoon, no, because I'm not making any salary and I can't invest outside Cocoon, of course, because that's the part of being in the fund. You know, you can only invest in early stage through Cocoon. So anyway, so we took the hard way and we are super 100%, 125% aligned with everyone because we need to create returns.
Yeah. It's so contra quote unquote mainstream, right? I mean, like you said, I think a lot of the paradigm, even for fund managers, is going to be okay. I'm going to raise $50 million fund. I'm going to raise $100 million fund. So at least, you know, this 2% management fee or 2.5% management fee makes sense. You know, I can pay myself a good salary, and then, you know, I'll do my meetings, and we go from there. But going this way, going the way that how Cocoon is set up is, of course, like you said, super aligned with the LPs, because the LPs will say like, there's less risk in that sense, because all the money that we allocate to this fund is going to go into startups.
Most of it. I mean, we have a small management fee. You see our staff, unfortunately, wants to have a salary.
So how does that work on... because for sure, still though, you know, the pressure of ROI and the pressure of the return of the fund is still happening, right? So that means you invest, you know, you deploy the whole fund, and then take us into the metrics, like initially, what was the initial fund, like fund number one, like how big was that fund and how fast did you deploy the fund?
So, okay, this is highly specific and interesting perhaps for future fund managers, but of course we hadn't run the fund before, right? Mm. We have been operating on our own balance sheet and done reasonably well. And of course, those investments are still paying my day-to-day expenses as they keep exiting. But we raised a small fund of around 10 million Singapore dollars. That was partly hard capital and commitments, and did that across 2 years. And then we raised a larger fund of 30 million Sing after that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
What we kind of looked at, so historically, you know, being a full-time business angel, we have been able to return 6-7 times.
Wow. Wow.
If you look at our Southeast Asian portfolio, so currently we have done around 7x actually.
Wow.
With a pretty good IRR, almost at 50%.
Yeah.
And we thought we should be able to do the same, more or less, if you run a slightly larger fund. So, you know, we basically told our investors, we're going to give you 5x, and that's what we are maintaining, and that's where we are.
Wow, that's amazing. Do you think that the metrics would still make sense if you would run, for example, a $100 million fund? Would you still be able to say like, okay, yeah, we're gonna quote unquote guarantee you, a 4 or 5x of the investment? Or is it a different game?
You see, you can give me $500 million if you want, that's fine. But I still don't want, I'm not still able to deploy it faster, right? Mm,
yeah.
So yeah. So if you give me $500 million or whatever you want to give me, the funds will just last longer. We will keep investing perhaps more in the later rounds. But I think the key to, I think, where we deliver returns and where we are playing is in the initial sourcing of the deals, to find those five deals, to find those five fantastic teams of entrepreneurs that can work with us and keep growing. And I have to say, I'm pretty proud that not a single company that we have invested in has shut down so far, which I think is a good metric.
Yeah,
I don't think we have 26 unicorns, but I'm pretty sure that there will be some really good success stories out of it. So I think another thing we looked at, which is interesting, if you look at and compare the VC space here and for example, in successful places like Silicon Valley, is that if you run a fund in Silicon Valley, you have a certain kind of assumption on what percentage of your companies will turn into unicorns or centaurs or whatever you call it, right? In Southeast Asia, since liquidity is less and since some of the ideas are for a more limited market, we're not looking for necessarily unicorns. We're looking for companies that can give us 20x return.
Yeah, right? I am. Yeah.
If I can sell a company for $100 million, or I would say the founders can sell the company at $100 million, they still make beautiful profits. They might not have been as much diluted. We make 30 or 20 times return.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful, and we're still happy. So I think what we always try to do, we try to make every single company in our portfolio survive, pivot. We spend a lot of resources on the companies that are not growing spectacularly well. I think the companies that are growing amazingly fast, we try not to do too much because obviously the founders know what to do.
Yeah.
So who are we to come and teach them anything? But for a lot of founders, they need some help. They need some a little bit of a push. They need perhaps some introductions. They need help to get the next fundraising going. Perhaps they need a bridge round. And that's where we spend a lot of resources.
Yeah, I love that because for sure, you know, I mean, if you look at the distribution of startups, the possibility that a startup, you know, would be like, let's say a $100 million company or even a $50 million company versus a unicorn is of course a bit skewed, right? So I totally agree. I agree with that investment thesis and it makes sense. On the website, it says something's beautiful because it says here that Cocoon is looking for the extraordinary founders, right? Extraordinary founders that dare to change, just like it says on your background there.
Yeah, it says there.
On the other side. which I can imagine, you know, if you say like, okay, you know, we only invest in, let's say, plus minus five founders, five companies that we believe, you know, we can add value to. What is kind of like your selection process, or what are the few things that you would categorize as, okay, this is an extraordinary founder?
Yeah, and that's a good point, because I think we invest more in founders than in ideas. and again, of course, if there are three extraordinary people that have a completely impossible business model, or they're trying to launch something that was done 5 years ago, of course we can't invest in that. But that's normally not the case. So what's an extraordinary founder? Let's start with it. So the team is an extraordinary team, I think, is a team that has some deep understanding / knowledge in terms of the product or service being delivered, and someone that can actually do it in a commercial way. That could be the same person, but that's extremely rare. Mm. It's usually across two people, sometimes three people. And then we try to spend a lot of time with the founders, right, to see if they are the right fit for us, if we feel the right energy, if they are interested in dialogue, for example, because not that it's so important to listen to what I'm thinking about the business, because again, I don't know the right answer, but if they're not able to have a dialogue with someone like us when we are investing, they also won't be able to have a dialogue with other people that actually know what they do or are domain experts or our potential future employees or key employees of them. So a lot of our interaction with founders is about finding out who they are and how they interact with people in general.
I love that.
And we spent more time on that, I guess, during the pandemic, because in many cases we invested in founders we never met before and they never met in real life. And I just met one of my founder teams recently, and that was quite fun. And I've been working with them for 18 months.
Wow.
So apparently it's quite important to find ways to establish that also in a remote fashion, right? Mm. Hopefully that won't be that important going forward. But the extraordinary founders, deeply committed and having a purpose to what they're doing. So when they're solving a problem, do they have a deeper purpose or a deeper drive to solve that particular problem? Mm. And then do they have the skills required to solve that problem? And three, can they communicate? Can they develop? Can they pivot? Can they both be driven by within, but also be driven by sensible and data from the outside in a nice combination where you're always kind of, you don't want to be floating in the wind and always following what mm-hmm. people are saying or what the trends are saying, but you also don't want to be driven completely from within and having this conviction of this is the right way of doing it. So it's this nice balance we're trying to find, and that's, to me, is an extraordinary founder.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because if I hear those points, it's very personal, right? It's very interpersonal. It's who this founder is. But at the same time, I bet you're bombarded by pitch decks with that all have a hockey stick curve and that all have a TAM, which is like $100 gazillion. But based on those decks, you still need to select, right? You still need to select, okay, with this company, I want to have another discussion. With this company, I want to have another discussion. And I can imagine, like just like you said, you've been working with your portfolio companies for months, years plus, and you've never met them. So how do you, in this context that we live in right now, where building relationships or really getting to know the drive of people, but through Zoom, like how has that been for you? Do you now trigger different senses so you can see, like through Zoom, you kind of like feel someone's energy and purpose?
Yeah, you know what, if you just are open to it, you can feel quite a lot of energy on Zoom. I mean, it's obviously harder. I'm not a native English speaker. Most of the people that we invest in are not native English speakers. So language is definitely a barrier that increases quite a bit when you are on Zoom, because people get more careful and more hesitant to speak. What we did was that we do some super light personality profiling, for example, super friendly tests, 100 questions that try to establish more of a communication patterns or preferences. So that is something we started doing during 2020. But I really hope that, travel restrictions are going to be lifted completely within the next 6 months. So I think this is hopefully nothing we have to worry about in my lifetime, but you never know. There might be a COVID 22 or COVID 24. I don't know.
Yeah.
And at least we are prepared, right?
For
how to handle that. But it's definitely difficult, for sure.
Yeah. Talking about extraordinary founders, there's of course also extraordinary investors, extraordinary fund managers, right? What do you think separates the good fund managers versus the extraordinary fund managers?
So there's a debate of if entrepreneurs make good investors or bad investors. I think entrepreneurs turn investors, if they do it in the right way, I think they are the ideal fund managers, especially at the early stage, right? Because there's so much going on that is so different when you're just starting up something. If you compare it to a series A, B, and C stage, where things are kind of more normal, at least at series B, at least it should be. I think a good fund manager has empathy and understanding of how it is to be an entrepreneur. Also someone that you can come to and ask for advice and that has a certain wisdom in a way, but not kind of delivering that wisdom in a way that forces anything onto the entrepreneurs. I think that's super important. It's so tempting. And I'm sure I do that mistake all the time. I did it in the beginning when I just started investing. I was probably the worst investor in the world. And I think I kind of realized after a while that I'm not running the company. First of all, I have a 10% stake or 20% stake now with Cocoon or more. Yes, I might be on the board. Yes, I might be the chairperson, but I have no extra vote on the board. The entrepreneurs are always in control. They always control the board. They are the ones doing day-to-day work in the company. They are also the ones that should know how to run the company. So as long as you keep reminding yourself that you don't know anything, and the best thing you can do is to kind of introduce to other people or introduce to different concepts, as long as you keep that in mind, I think you can be a great investor. Even if you do not have an entrepreneurial background, which is not that normal if you look at the VC partners across Singapore, although you see a lot of funds actually having that now more and more, even though after a while you will work with so many startups that you kind of sometimes you feel like an entrepreneur yourself, even if you're not running the company. But just to be aware of that distinction between running the company and being on the board, I think that's super important.
Yeah, I love that. At the end of the day, it's still the entrepreneur that's building the business. And I think you as the fund manager, at least, are a quote unquote cheerleader or, you know, really advisor at the side, right? Will, a final question I have, because I just love, I think also even the way you talk is I think very much because you've been there, you know how it is to build from scratch. So now how you invest, I think is also with a different lens, which I can really appreciate. And especially like slow investing, so to say, is a beautiful concept, refreshing to say the least.
Slow and patient. That's another thing.
Yeah.
You don't want to exit your company after 2 years, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Will, final question of the interview. We fast forward far away into the future. And on this day, your digital footprint and all your accolades that you've achieved in the marketplace are erased. So I can't find anything about Will Klipkin. There's nothing I can find except for three bullet
points. That'd be great.
Except for three bullet points. And these three bullet points, they represent the life lessons that Will wants to leave the world with. Like, what would those three bullet points be?
First of all, I think the world is at the stage right now where I think you need to do something meaningful when you're doing a business. If you can do something meaningful versus doing something that just makes you rich, I would really think that people should do something meaningful that contributes to the, you know, future of the planet. I would say use your resources, start a company that makes the world a better place. I'm not the first one saying that, but I can see that, you know, entrepreneurs have so much potential to change things. And that's also why our slogan is "Dare to Change." We like entrepreneurs that can actually make a dent, you know, and make things cheaper, better, improve the lives of people around them. The second thing I think is, I don't know. Just do the best you can. Nobody can ask you to do anything more. Just you know, approach issues you have with a positive mindset and work with people around you. Make people around you your friends and partner with people. Don't make enemies. And I don't really have anything else to say. That's a big question you're asking.
Yeah, it is. But I think that those two points are already great. And again, I need to salute you, Will, for just your journey. I think it's inspiring to say the least. And you know, the way you're investing, and I think the investment philosophy of Cocoon is also something which is amazing, right? So I want to thank you so much for joining the podcast, joining the interview. You know, all the way from Norway. If people want to learn more about Cocoon, is there any specific site they need to go to?
Well, go to our website, drop an email at will@cocooncap.com. If you have a great idea, if you would like to consider us as your investor for your seed stage fundraise, go to apply.cocooncap.com. We have quite an unusual policy. Every Friday, every single application gets shown to all members of Cocoon, the entire team. And everyone is looking at it, and we go through every single thing, and we progress it from there. We are kind of known to be one of the fastest investors. If we like something, we act very fast. We are quite nimble.
Amazing.
And we're always looking for the next big thing and the next entrepreneur who dares to change and make something better and faster and cheaper.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I'll put everything on the show notes. Again, Will, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Learned a lot. And I hope to see you in Bali or in Singapore soon.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then please make sure to subscribe over on Apple or Spotify. And I'd really appreciate it if you can leave a rating and review and let me know what your biggest takeaway is this episode. Thanks again, and I hope to see you in the next one.